shedding, as they are called, are more persistent now than ever, and water shortages are worsening. The situation is fluid. Nuclear power and coal imports may soon alleviate the power blackouts, even as the army has reportedly moved away somewhat from encouraging Islamic radicalism. But Pakistan's population growth is still above 2% annually, meaning its population doubles every 35 years. The median age is 22.7 years old. Corruption is rife, even as there are no significant anti-corruption drives. Karachi, a sprawling city of slums and fortified villas with a population of 24 million, is defined by criminal networks and refugees from the violent tribal areas abutting Afghanistan. Because of security concerns, more and more Pakistani political conclaves have been held not in Pakistan at all, but in Dubai. Still, the Pakistani state will not collapse, as it basically consists of around 100 wealthy families. It is such families who will benefit the most financially from the Silk Road project. This oligarchy is actually similar to the one in the Philippines, another vast, institutionally weak, overcrowded state with a difficult geography. Of course, Pakistan, unlike the Philippines, has a reported 200 nuclear weapons, even as it is reportedly building smaller tactical ones and dispersing them around the country so that they may be harder for the Americans to locate. The pattern continues, in other words. In the vast area between a cratering Levant and an internally troubled China, no state is improving its capacity to govern effectively. They are all either weakening or headed nowhere good. Pakistan's chronic instability could well limit China's ability to complete its Silk Road project from the Indian Ocean northward into western China, with a band of separatist violence from Balochistan in the south to Xinjiang in the north perpetually simmering along the whole route. In this way, China, as a secure domestic entity, might only exist within, say, its greater arable cradle, from which tentacles of lucrative trade protrude outward. Thus, the true map of China and its shadow zones, again, would resemble the medieval one that Marco Polo knew. In terms of the dry land portion of the earth, no region will do more by itself to tell us who wields more power and how stable things really are in the early 21st century than Greater Central Asia, encompassing the Caucasus, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Consider Afghanistan for a moment. The U.S. military can arguably save face in Afghanistan, but it cannot stabilize it. If anyone holds the key to economically and perhaps even politically stabilizing Afghanistan, it is mainly China through resource extraction, and also the Caspian Sea countries through the building of a natural gas transport network south through Afghanistan to the Indian Ocean. Meanwhile, India and Iran work together to counter the influence of Pakistan and Saudi Arabia in Afghanistan. If the Indians and the Iranians can build the Chabahar port and transport project, linking that Iranian port on the Indian Ocean with Central Asia, with a spur line into Afghanistan, it can then compete with the China-Pakistan Silk Road project extending northward from Gwadar. As for the Russians, who have an interest in fighting Islamic extremism in Afghanistan because of Afghanistan's contiguity with the former Soviet Union, they continue to develop their intelligence contacts with both Pakistan and Iran. Afghanistan provides a signal lesson about the limits of American power, coupled with the continued relevance of geography, which Washington elites fail to respect at their peril. Afghanistan, which has been at war in one form or another for almost four decades, and Pakistan, which has never really been safe from tribal insurgencies and political turmoil for almost seven decades, demonstrate that the configuration of the Indian subcontinent into two larger states and several smaller ones may not be the last word in human political organization there. To wit, the political map may evolve over time. Pakistan can partially crumble into a rump greater Punjab, with Balochistan and Sindh gaining more de facto independence, with vast implications for India. And it is the Indian subcontinent that I am talking about. since parts of Afghanistan were incorporated into various Indian imperial dynasties, governments in New Delhi always have considered Afghanistan in conceptual terms as part of a greater India, stretching from the Iranian plateau in the west to the Burmese jungles in the east. Whereas China seeks to expand vertically south to the Indian Ocean, India seeks to expand horizontally along or close to the Indian Ocean, with a special growing influence in the Persian Gulf. Therein lies the contest between these two fated empires. The flattening Himalayas and the nationalist undercurrent. Indeed, the defeat of distance effected by military technology has created a new strategic geography of rivalry between India and China. Indian ballistic missiles can reach cities in China's arable cradle, while Chinese fighter jets can reach the Indian subcontinent. Indian warships are in the South China Sea, while Chinese warships sail throughout the Indian Ocean, with China deeply involved in port development projects in the Bay of Bengal and Arabian Sea that virtually surround India on three sides. The high wall of the Himalayas no longer separates these two great civilizations, and hasn't for some time. Trade routes linking China and India, by way of Tibet, Nepal, West Bengal, and Myanmar, joining Lhasa, Kathmandu, and Kolkata, will only further mature, with peaceful commerce cushioning the impact of this new strategic geography. But these widened tentacles of vehicular transport also might be used for Chinese tanks to enter India. Again, connectivity does not necessarily presage a more peaceful world. Eurasia is cohering into both a single trade and conflict system. Oxford historian and archaeologist Barry Cunliffe writes that the maritime network of the Portuguese in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, whose ports and trading posts punctuated the entire Indian Ocean seaboard, helped bring the vast Eurasian landmass into a new global system. The Chinese, with their investments in Indian Ocean ports in Myanmar, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Djibouti, and Tanzania, are doing for the postmodern era what the Portuguese did for the late medieval and early modern ones, even while the map lines connecting these new and expanded ports approximate Marco Polo's return route. The nexus of China, the Middle East, and Africa now accounts for more than half of world trade, writes Parag Khanna. This is truly a Chinese maritime empire we are talking about. Like that of the Portuguese, it is mainly limited to the coast and does not guarantee China pivotal influence inland. Myanmar's political liberalization offers the example of a country reaching out to India and the United States to avoid domination by China. Geography still rules, but globalization and the communications revolution amplify the opportunities for out-of-area powers. Furthermore, while the ships of the Portuguese and the Spanish may have invented the global system, that system's very complexity now has reached a point where it embraces a multidimensional and interlocking tendency for violent conflict. And keep another thing in mind. Both China and Russia have influence of increasing imperial dimensions, even as they weaken internally from economic stresses of a profound and structural kind. The very fragility of these highly centralized Politburo-style regimes inside their own countries makes them increasingly aggressive beyond their borders, since nationalism can serve as a unifying element in times of societal stress. China and Russia are the hinge states on which the organization of this entire Eurasian conflict system depends, and given the constricted and copious interactions from one end of the supercontinent to the other, future palace coups and intrigues in Beijing and Moscow can trigger fires throughout the Eastern Hemisphere. The surface of this world will be cosmopolitan, but with nationalism, as China and Russia demonstrate, still composing the bedrock. To be sure, city-states such as Qatar, Dubai, and Singapore illustrate that cosmopolitan surface. One can't help but think of the eclectic cities of the Levant at the turn of the 20th century, Alexandria, Smyrna, and Beirut, where, writes historian Philip Manzel, people switched identities as easily as they switched languages. And regarding Odessa of the same period, there was nothing national about this cosmopolitan city. Salonika, too, fell within this exciting category, but here, more darkly, as ethnic nationalism began to take hold, Muslims turned into Turks, Christians into Greeks, explains Columbia professor Mark Mazower. For the easygoing Ottoman imperial tolerance, which allowed for such a high degree of cosmopolitanism in the first place, was giving way to the hardened national and ethnic divides that have been a feature of the industrial and post-industrial ages. Imperialism and cosmopolitanism go together, in other words, since empires are, by definition, multi-ethnic and multi-religious, whatever their bad reputation. But the end of formal imperialism and the continued internal weakening of faded empires that we see now are not friendly to postmodern forms of those multicultural Levantine cities. The city-states of the Persian Gulf and Singapore, with their international workforces, may somewhat resemble old Alexandria and Smyrna, but certainly not Aleppo, Mosul, or Karachi, where the collapse of European imperial rule spawned authoritarian and sectarian states that either have disintegrated or, in the case of Pakistan, are extremely dysfunctional. In such places, communal violence is the norm, and there is no sense of a patria. Because the Gulf states and Singapore depend on a vibrant world trading order, which in turn depends on a stable balance of power, they provide little fundamental security of their own, and therefore, in geopolitical terms, constitute an illusion. Violent Shiite separatism in eastern Saudi Arabia, a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and warfare in the South China Sea could wreck these city-state economies. The continued accumulation of corporate wealth, which these city-states represent, is more fragile and contingent than we think. Consider the port of Al-Dukum, which I visited recently, built midway along a largely bleak and uninhabited Omani coastline. A multi-billion-dollar rail and shipping complex taking advantage of Indian Ocean traffic between Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, Al-Dukum did not even exist a few years ago. It is a testament to the continued power of location, of geography. Because Al-Dukum lies just outside the Persian Gulf, but is proximate to it, conflict within the Gulf actually increases the importance of Al-Dukum, whose rail and pipeline terminuses, in the future originating as far north as Kuwait, will fill waiting ships that dock in safety outside the Strait of Hormuz. Moreover, Al-Dukum was built in the expectation that the U.S. Fifth Fleet soon will want a more secure harbor than those available inside the Gulf. Al-Dukum, which shrinks the Eurasian trading system down to one port complex, is a monument to pessimism. It assumes future conflict and the instability that comes with connectivity. The Contracting Rimland and the Meaning of Bulgaria. This increasingly crowded and interconnected world will have so many layers of horizontal linkages between one part of Afro-Eurasia and another that it will be increasingly difficult for the United States to exert pressure on it. China, Russia, and Iran will be part of the same supply chain of trade and transportation that works to thwart U.S. influence. In the past, Eurasia was simply too vast to work to the advantage of any one power. The Mongol Empire, from Genghis Khan to Tamerlane, and including Kublai Khan, was the singular, stunning exception to this. But as technology has collapsed distance, advancing the possibilities of trade and supply chains, there is now the possibility of some semblance of Eurasian unity among China, Russia, and Iran, with China as the first among equals, just as in Marco Polo's day. But whereas in the High Middle Ages the Yuan Empire posed no challenge to Europe, in a more shrunken, tightly wound world of high technology, the challenge to the United States of such a Eurasian trading network is obvious. Of course, opportunities will arise for the United States, ironically due to this very connectivity, as when Myanmar uses the United States to balance against China. and as the principal geographical satellite of the Afro-Eurasian landmass, North America will remain pivotal to world history even while it is protected from many of the disruptions that will overtake Afro-Eurasia itself. For this is a world that will be more volatile precisely because of the growth of middle and working classes that are less stoical than the rural poor, of which there will be less. Indeed, it is the shantytown, the incubator of misery and utopian ideology, that will help define the megacities of Afro-Eurasia. The more urbanized, the more educated, and even the more enlightened the world becomes, counterintuitively, the more politically unstable it becomes too. This is what techno-optimists and those who inhabit the world of fancy corporate gatherings are prone to miss. They wrongly equate wealth creation, and unevenly distributed wealth creation at that, with political order and stability. Nevertheless, the United States has a problem. For a century, it has sought to prevent any one power from gaining the same degree of dominance in the Eastern Hemisphere that it itself possesses in the Western Hemisphere. And that is still certainly possible. While one power per se may not gain such dominance, however, a grouping of powers might, with a de-Westernized Europe, Russia, Turkey, and Iran leveraging the power of China through trade and Silk Road connectivity. Eurasia is getting smaller, and that may make it harder for the United States to play one power on the supercontinent off against the other. Think of a world with more conflict and disruption, amplified by technology and the growth of megacities, while at the same time evincing a degree of economic unity, encouraged by new infrastructure on land and maritime platforms at sea in the greater Indian Ocean, that will thwart American influence in the old world. The United States will remain the most potent individual power, but that will mean less and less as powers on the same supercontinent find themselves more closely linked by trade. Yet, given the political weakening and stagnation I have described throughout the greater Middle East and Central Asia, this is a very contradictory picture I have laid out. And that is the point. For the world is going in different directions, and the sheer scale of activity will make dominance from any one geographical point like ours harder. Perhaps no place provides an insight into the challenge faced by the United States more than Bulgaria, just one of the many countries that are invisible to the Washington policy elite and consequently are never part of its conversation. Bulgaria is a member of NATO and the European Union, but it is located at the far southeastern end of Europe, historically part of the Near East, or Turkey in Europe, as much of the Balkans were labeled in the late 19th century. Bulgaria was the most loyal Warsaw Pact satellite of the Soviet Union during the Cold War. In the 1990s and first decade of the 2000s, following America's victory in the Cold War, and a time when NATO and the EU appeared invincible, Bulgaria saw its future wholly inside the West. American and Western power back then was such that, even as few in Washington focused on the country, it was safe within our embrace. Bulgaria's border with Turkey, its proximity to Russia, and its closely related Slavic language did not seem to matter as much as they used to. American power, it appeared, had defeated geography. Fast forward to today. Bulgaria is still in NATO and the EU, but the Russians and the Turks are aggressively competing for the destiny of the country, with Turkey being among Bulgaria's biggest trading partners, and the Russians especially involved in various forms of subversion, from organized crime to encouraging nationalist parties. Bulgaria, because of its weak institutions and the increasing inability of Brussels to project power into its own far-flung hinterlands, is a compromised country whose political integrity nobody trusts. The unipolarity that defined the post-Cold War is over. The West itself is dissipating, and we are back to classical geography, particularly in Europe. Indeed, what was supposed to have been a monochrome superstate from Iberia to the Black Sea, integral to the very conception of the West, is now decaying into various color tones on a neo-medieval map, with various layers of political and even civilizational identity. There is still the EU, but also individual states, regions, and city-states, with liberalism barely holding off the forces of populist nationalism. To say that this does not undermine the strength of NATO is to be in denial, especially as regional military groupings, Baltic Scandinavia, Visegrad, strengthen within Europe. NATO will continue to exist in full, but, even more so in the future than in the past, emergencies will require the United States to force the alliance into action. Without powerful arm-twisting by the United States, even an Article 5 violation by Russia may not rouse NATO on its own, beyond the holding of meetings and more meetings. Yet, as the example of Bulgaria indicates, Russia does not require an invasion, only a zone of influence in the intermarium that it can achieve by gradually compromising the democratic vitality of Rhineland states. Hungary, in particular, is well on its way in this regard. Again, Eurasia and the Near East increasingly begin inside Europe. A stark realization emerges. America can defend its interests, modestly defined, but it cannot change the world into a version of itself. In a word, we cannot ultimately defend Bulgaria, let alone Iraq or Afghanistan, from within. The geopolitics of a naval power. Our response to this entire dilemma begins with defining accurately who we are. In geopolitical terms, the United States is a maritime power, operating from the greatest of the island satellites of the Eurasian supercontinent, whose mission is to defend a free trading order from which we ourselves benefit. In the tradition of the British Imperial Navy, we protect the global commons. Free trade works in tandem with liberal democracies, but does not necessarily require them. Countries such as Morocco, Egypt, Jordan, Oman, Taiwan, and Singapore have, over the span of the decades, fallen under the category of enlightened dictatorships that nevertheless have been conducive to liberal values worldwide. Our allies are mainly democracies, but not always so, as these examples suggest. The world is intractable enough, and becoming more so, without our needing to impose our values on other countries' internal systems. Thus, we should start with asking how we can act with caution and restraint, without drifting into neo-isolationism. Air and naval power are actually suited to a restrained foreign policy, since it is about projecting power over broad reaches of the earth without getting bogged down with land forces in any one place, and without incurring significant casualties. We must keep our limitations in mind, especially as the two signal advantages of U.S. power projection since the end of World War II have been steadily eroding. The advantage of being the only major country whose infrastructure was not either decimated or severely damaged between 1941 and 1945, and the advantage of having had a big internal market that for a long time protected its workers from the rigors of global competition. Our middle class was built on this internal market, and thus was willing and able for decades to support vast military expenditures. But while our position has been eroding, the internal positions of Eurasia's two principal hinge states, Russia and China, have been eroding further. They have ethnic, political, and economic challenges of a fundamental structural kind, compared to which ours pale in significance. Their very future stability and existence as unitary states can be questioned, whereas ours cannot. And the world I have been describing in Eurasia, defined by non-stop crises and political stagnation and weakness, a world where chaos and wealth creation go hand in hand, is one that will help keep our competitors preoccupied. State capacity in Eurasia is declining. Meanwhile, energy-rich and self-sufficient, bordered by oceans and the Canadian Arctic, we have breathing room that the Eurasian powers do not, even if we will not be able to influence the power balance on the supercontinent in the way that we used to. The age of comparative anarchy is upon us. Here it is wise to review why we have had so much influence in the Asia-Pacific region, even as we are located half a world away, and even in the face of a rising China, which constitutes East Asia's geographic and economic core. It isn't only our naval presence that buys us so much influence there. It is our naval presence merged with the realization among all Pacific nations that, precisely because we are only a distant geographical satellite of Eurasia, we have no territorial ambitions in their region. To repeat, North America's very distance from East Asia means our influence there cannot be overbearing, and thus we are trusted. We are the reputational power and honest broker, defending a system of free trade upon which every regional economy depends. Therefore, it is time now to extend the concept of the Asia pivot to encompass the entire navigable rimland of Eurasia, including not only the Western Pacific, but the Indian Ocean as well, with our influence following exactly the path of Marco Polo's return by sea from China to Venice. Sea power is the compensatory answer for shaping geopolitics, to the extent that it can be shaped, in the face of an infernally complex and intractable situation on land. Here is where the ideas of Alfred Thayer Mahan meet those of Halford Mackinder. Sea power does not mean domination at sea. It does not necessarily mean a significant expansion of our navy. It means conceptually merging our presence in the Persian Gulf region with that in the South and East China Seas. It means leveraging the growing naval presence of India, a de facto American ally, in the Arabian Sea and the Bay of Bengal. More specifically, we will require the 21st century equivalent of coaling stations in rimland locations whose stability is defensible, where we can pre-position locations and conduct long-range strikes off ships. Oman, Diego Garcia, India, and Singapore come to mind. Our land strategy should be secondary and should follow from our air and naval strategy, not the other way around. A land strategy that is paramount defines an imperial military more than does an air and sea strategy, since land forces are synonymous with occupation. We must move away from domain control to domain denial, since our only motive to be on the ground in the greater Middle East and Central Asia is for smackdown or disruption purposes. In retrospect, that is how we should have handled Afghanistan after 9/11. As we learned to our horror at the turn of the 20th century in the Philippines, as well as in the 1960s in Vietnam, and again in the last decade in Iraq, to invade is to govern. Once you decide to send in ground forces in significant numbers, it becomes your job to administer the territory you've just conquered, or to identify someone immediately who can. That's why, particularly since the end of the military occupation of Japan in 1952, we have been both more comfortable and better off as a status quo power, accepting regimes as they are, democratic or not. The geopolitical situation I have outlined in the vast space between Europe and China is such that America should use every opportunity to stay militarily disengaged, unless an overwhelming national interest forces our hand. And that may happen from time to time in a world of cyber attacks and nuclear proliferation. Still, the instability and complexity that we see now will only intensify in Inner Asia. Thus, there will not be more, but actually fewer opportunities to intervene successfully on a grand scale, even as the temptation to do so may grow. Our interests in terms of the bar for military intervention are mainly negative, to prevent a non-state actor, or a state actor working in sync with a non-state one, from planning or launching an attack on ourselves or our allies, and to prevent a Silk Road trading network from creating a demonstrably hostile Eurasian superpower or alliance of sorts, with the same level of influence in the Eastern Hemisphere that the United States enjoys in the Western Hemisphere. Britain's historic effort to prevent any one power from gaining dominance over the European mainland is similar to ours now in Eurasia. But our Western Pacific and Indian Ocean sea power can work to restrain that, without the need for large-scale ground force intervention. To be sure, China's island reclamations in the South China Sea and its port development projects in the Indian Ocean all work to push our navy away from the Eurasian mainland. This is where the Iranian-Indian alliance to develop the Chabahar port in Iranian Balochistan, to undermine the Chinese-Pakistani port project in Pakistani Balochistan, actually works in our favor. At least along Marco Polo's route, we always should seek to occupy the territory between neo-isolationism and imperial-style interventionism. That means more drones, more precision-guided missiles, more cyber capabilities, and more special operations forces for various missions, not fewer. We must be comfortable operating at levels smaller than that of a brigade, in other words. This is how we guard our negative interests and shape the battle space to the degree that we can, while lessening the risk of outright occupation anywhere. Foreign internal defense, the low-key training of local forces that compete with forces hostile to U.S. interests, is the way we will forge outcomes, where such a possibility even exists. To this end, we will need to strengthen our foreign area officer program with first-tier recruits, not second- and third-tier ones as we often do now. The decline of states in general in Inner Asia means a future of more refugees. We will have to become expert at using refugee camps for intelligence gathering at a time in history when our adversaries try to weaponize refugees. Obviously, diplomacy will be altogether crucial in many of these efforts, in which there will be no victory parades, even as the Westphalian system of modern states weakens and calcifies. Of course, we must maintain robust land forces for the sake of unpredictable contingencies, as well as to demonstrate clearly that we always reserve the right to intervene, even if we don't or shouldn't. The fact is, a robust land force in and of itself affects the power calculations of our adversaries to our advantage. This may seem like a prohibitively expensive insurance policy, but the cost of not maintaining deployable land forces would be far greater in terms of the temptations offered to expansionist autocratic states such as Russia, China, and Iran, especially as they internally weaken and consequently employ nationalism as a solidifying force. Yet, despite the threats of Russian and Chinese expansionism, particularly in the Baltic, Black, and South China Seas, the more important underlying dynamic will be the crises of central control inside Russia and China themselves as their authoritarian systems degenerate. This will happen alongside decaying Turkish and Iranian imperial structures, even while Europe itself becomes more fractured and less trustworthy, and besieged as the years go on with refugees from sub-Saharan Africa, to say nothing of the Middle East. Alas, as I've indicated, modernism, with its neatly defined bureaucratic states and borders, is receding in the rearview mirror across Eurasia. The current bout of populist nationalism that we see is merely its swan song. To recap, at a more profound and yet less obvious level, there is, as the French philosopher Pierre Manon intimates, a growing emphasis on city-states and the half-hidden traditions of empire, even while the problems of modern states increase. We may be back to what Manon calls the age-old political formulations of city, empire, and tribe, or ethnos. Meanwhile, across Eurasia, the state itself, that more recent invention, suffers. Thus, the map increasingly will be defined by a new medievalism as the Westphalian model, with which the United States has traditionally been comfortable intervening and interacting, becomes increasingly less relevant. Europe will form the crucible of this age of comparative anarchy, the place that millions from these weakening states desperately want to get into. But an America that consciously seeks to keep its powder dry and maintains a degree of sea control in the Eastern Hemisphere will be, at least in geopolitical terms, relatively safe. The Peloponnesian War? But can America keep its powder dry? As I write, Washington elites are busy demonizing the rulers of Russia and China, and are obsessed with going toe-to-toe with those two autocratic powers in the Baltic, Black, and South China and East China Seas. There may be grounds for arguing, as I and others have, for a more robust response to Russian and Chinese probing operations in these areas, After all, an altogether weak response to probing tempts the other side to miscalculate its strength, a common cause of wars. But given just how many scenarios exist for an outbreak of hostilities in these increasingly fraught conflict zones, the question nobody asks, and that is utterly absent from the policy debate, is, once violent hostilities begin, how do you end a war with Russia or China? Like the nations involved in World War I, the United States, Russia, and China in the 21st century will have the capacity to keep on fighting even if one or the other loses a major clash or missile exchange. This has far-reaching implications. For the problem is, both Russia and China are dictatorships, not democracies. Therefore, losing face for them would be much more catastrophic than it would be for an American president. Politically speaking, they may be unable to give up the fight. And so we too might have to fight on until there is some form of a regime change or a substantial reduction in Moscow's or Beijing's military capacity. The world would not be the same after. We imagine a war in the Baltic Sea Basin or the South China Sea as short, intense, and contained, but who knows what it might unleash? Washington has done almost no thinking about that. After World War I, after Iraq even, we never should imagine war as easy or surgically confined to one place. We assume, without too much thinking, that any regime change in these places will be for the better, but it easily could be for the worse. Both Putin and Xi Jinping are rational actors, holding back more extreme elements. They are bold, but not crazy. The idea that more liberal regimes might replace them is an illusion. Given their decaying authoritarian systems and the buildup both of ethnic tensions and economic problems inside Russia and China, the alternative danger is that, rather than another strong ruler or a move toward stable democracy, we will see a partial breakdown of order itself in Moscow, and perhaps even in Beijing, upon which, as I have written, the very coherence of Eurasia hinges. Remember the overarching theme of this essay, the tightly wound interconnectedness of weakening states and faded empires across Eurasia. The world of the digital age is like a taut web. Tweak one string, and the whole network vibrates. This means a flare-up in the Baltic or South China Sea is not only about the Baltic or South China Sea. Nothing is local anymore. Connectivity itself magnifies the effect of military miscalculation. The Peloponnesian War that engulfed all of Greece had its origins in relatively minor conflicts involving Corcyra and Potidaea, which helped drive tensions between Athens and Sparta to the breaking point. Because of the way technology has collapsed distance, Eurasia is now no less a coherent conflict system than were the city-states of ancient Greece. And the basic unit of our world, the state, is itself in decline in too many places. In the interest of thinking tragically in order to avoid tragedy, policymakers need to worry about how not to provoke more anarchy than the world has already seen. Beginning in the late 19th century and leading up to World War I, the Eastern question, what to do about the weakening Ottoman Empire in the Balkans and the Middle East, dominated European geopolitics. The Eastern question has now been replaced by the Eurasian question, what to do about the weakening of states on the supercontinent, as older imperial legacies move to the forefront. 2. The Art of Avoiding War. The Atlantic, June 2015. The Scythians were nomadic horsemen who dominated a vast realm of the Pontic Steppe north of the Black Sea, in present-day Ukraine and southern Russia, from the 7th century to the 3rd century BC. Unlike other ancient peoples who left not a trace, the Scythians continued to haunt and terrify long after they were gone. Herodotus recorded that they ravaged the whole of Asia. They not only took tribute from each people, but also made raids and pillaged everything these peoples had. Napoleon, on witnessing the Russians' willingness to burn down their own capital rather than hand it over to his army, reputedly said, "They are Scythians." The more chilling moral for modern audiences involves not the Scythians' cruelty, but rather their tactics against the invading Persian army of Darius early in the 6th century BC. As Darius's infantry marched east near the Sea of Azov, hoping to meet with the Scythian war bands in a decisive battle, the Scythians kept withdrawing into the immense reaches of their territory. Darius was perplexed and sent the Scythian king, Identhyrsus, a challenge. "If you think yourself stronger, stand and fight. If not, submit." Identhyrsus replied that since his people had neither cities nor cultivated land for an enemy to destroy, they had nothing to defend, and thus no reason to give battle. Instead, his men harassed and skirmished with Persian foraging parties, then quickly withdrew over and over again. Each time, small groups of Persian cavalry fled in disorder, while the main body of Darius's army weakened as it marched farther and farther away from its base and supply lines. Darius ultimately retreated from Scythia, essentially defeated, without ever having had the chance to fight. Killing the enemy is easy, in other words. It is finding him that is difficult. This is as true today as ever. The landscape of war is now vaster and emptier of combatants than it was during the set-piece battles of the Industrial Age. Related lessons? Don't go hunting ghosts, and don't get too deep into a situation where your civilizational advantage is of little help. Or, as the Chinese sage of early antiquity Sun Tzu famously said, "The side that knows when to fight and when not will take the victory. There are roadways not to be traveled, armies not to be attacked, walled cities not to be assaulted." A case in point comes from the ill-fated Sicilian expedition of the late 5th century BC, chronicled by Thucydides, in which Athens sent a small force to far-off Sicily in support of allies there, only to be drawn deeper and deeper into the conflict until the prestige of its whole maritime empire became dependent upon victory. Thucydides' story is especially poignant in the wake of Vietnam and Iraq. With the Athenians, as with Darius, one is astonished by how the obsession with honor and reputation can lead a great power toward a bad fate. The image of Darius's army marching into nowhere on an inhospitable steppe in search of an enemy that never quite appears is so powerful that it goes beyond mere symbolism. Your enemy will not meet you on your own terms, only on his. That is why asymmetric warfare is as old as history. When fleeting insurgents planted car bombs and harassed marines and soldiers in the warrens of Iraqi towns, they were Scythians. When the Chinese harass the Filipino Navy and make territorial claims with fishing boats, Coast Guard vessels, and oil rigs, all while avoiding any confrontation with U.S. warships, they are Scythians. And when the warriors of the Islamic State arm themselves with knives and video cameras, they too are Scythians. Largely because of these Scythians, the United States has only limited ability to determine the outcome of many conflicts, despite being a superpower. America is learning an ironic truth of empire. You endure by not fighting every battle. In the 1st century AD, Tiberius preserved Rome by not interfering in bloody internecine conflicts beyond its northern frontier. Instead, he practiced strategic patience as he watched the carnage. He understood the limits of Roman power. The United States does not chase after war bands in Yemen as Darius did in Scythia, but occasionally it kills individuals from the air. The fact that it uses drones is proof not of American strength, but of American limitations. The Obama administration must recognize these limitations and not allow, for example, the country to be drawn deeper into the conflict in Syria. If the United States helps topple the dictator Bashar al-Assad on Wednesday, then what will it do on Thursday when it finds that it has helped midwife to power a Sunni jihadist regime, or on Friday when ethnic cleansing of the Shia-trending Alawites commences? Perhaps this is a battle that, as Sun Tzu might conclude, should not be fought. But Assad has killed many tens of thousands, maybe more, and he is being supported by the Iranians. True. But remember that emotion, however righteous, can be the enemy of analysis. So, how can the U.S. avoid Darius's fate? How can it avoid being undone by pride, while still fulfilling its moral responsibility as a great power? It should use proxies wherever it can find them, even among adversaries. If the Iranian-backed Houthis are willing to fight al-Qaeda in Yemen, why should Americans be opposed? And if the Iranians ignite a new phase of sectarian war in Iraq, let that be their own undoing, as they themselves fail to understand the lesson of the Scythians. While the Middle East implodes through years of low-intensity conflict among groups of Scythians, let Turkey, Egypt, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Iran jostle toward an uneasy balance of power, and the United States remain a half-step removed. Caution, after all, is not the same as capitulation. Finally, let the United States return to its roots as a maritime power in Asia, and a defender on land in Europe, where there are fewer Scythians and more ordinary villains. Scythians are the nemesis of missionary nations, nations that obey no limits. Certainly America should reach, but not, like Darius, overreach. 3. The Tragedy of U.S. Foreign Policy. The National Interest, August 1, 2013. For over 2 years, the civil war in Syria has been synonymous with cries of moral urgency. Do something, shout those who demand the United States intervene militarily to set the situation there to rights, even as the battle lines now comprise hundreds of regime and rebel groupings, and the rebels have started fighting each other. Well then, shout the moral interventionists, if only we had intervened earlier. Syria is not unique. Before Syria, humanitarians in 2011 demanded military intervention in Libya, even though the regime of Muammar Gaddafi had given up its nuclear program and had been cooperating for years with Western intelligence agencies. In fact, the United States and France did lead an intervention, and Libya today is barely a state, with Tripoli less a capital than the weak point of imperial-like arbitration for far-flung militias, tribes, and clans, while nearby Saharan entities are in greater disarray because of weapons flooding out of Libya. The 1990s were full of calls for humanitarian intervention, in Rwanda, which tragically went unheeded, and in Bosnia and Kosovo, where interventions, while belated, were by and large successful. Free from the realpolitik necessities of the Cold War, humanitarians have, in the past 2 decades, tried to reduce foreign policy to an aspect of genocide prevention. Indeed, the Nazi Holocaust is only one lifetime removed from our own, a nanosecond in human history, and so post-Cold War foreign policy now rightly exists in the shadow of it. The codified upshot has been R2P, the responsibility to protect, the mantra of humanitarians. But American foreign policy cannot merely be defined by R2P and never again. Statesmen can only rarely be concerned with humanitarian interventions and protecting human rights to the exclusion of other considerations. The United States, like any nation, but especially because it is a great power, simply has interests that do not always cohere with its values. That is tragic, but it is a tragedy that has to be embraced and accepted. What are those overriding interests? The United States, as the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere, must always prevent any other power from becoming equally dominant in the Eastern Hemisphere. Moreover, as a liberal maritime power, the United States must seek to protect the sea lines of communication that enable world trade. It must also seek to protect both treaty and de facto allies, and especially their access to hydrocarbons. These are all interests that, while not necessarily contradictory to human rights, simply do not operate in the same category. Because the United States is a liberal power, its interests, even when they are not directly concerned with human rights, are generally moral. But they are only secondarily moral. For seeking to adjust the balance of power in one's favor has been throughout history an amoral enterprise, pursued by both liberal and illiberal powers. Nevertheless, when a liberal power like the United States pursues such a goal in the service of preventing war among major states, it is acting morally in the highest sense. A telling example of this tension, one that gets to the heart of why never again and R2P cannot always be the operative words in statesmanship, was recently provided by the foreign affairs expert Leslie H. Gelb. Gelb noted that after Saddam Hussein had gassed close to 7,000 Kurds to death in northern Iraq in 1988, even a truly ethical Secretary of State, George Shultz, committed a moral outrage. For Shultz basically ignored the incident and continued supporting Saddam in his war against Iran because weakening Iran, not protecting the citizens of Iraq, was the primary American interest at the time. So, was Shultz acting immorally? Not completely, I believe. Shultz was operating under a different morality than the one normally applied by humanitarians. His was a public morality, not a private one. He and the rest of the Reagan administration had a responsibility to the hundreds of millions of Americans under their charge. And while these millions were fellow countrymen, they were more crucially voters and citizens, essentially strangers who did not know Shultz or Reagan personally, but who had entrusted the two men with their interests. And the American public's interest clearly dictated that of the two states, Iran and Iraq, Iran at the time constituted the greater threat. In protecting the public interest of even a liberal power, a statesman cannot always be nice or humane. I am talking here of a morality of public outcomes rather than one of private intentions. By supporting Iraq, the Reagan administration succeeded in preventing Iran in the last years of the Cold War from becoming a regional hegemon. That was an outcome convenient to U.S. interests, even if the morality of the affair was ambiguous, given that Iraq's regime was at the time the more brutal of the two. In seeking good outcomes, policymakers are usually guided by constraints, a realistic awareness of what, for instance, the United States should and should not do given its finite resources. After all, the United States had hundreds of thousands of troops tied down in Europe and Northeast Asia during the Cold War, and thus had to contain Iran through the use of a proxy, Saddam's Iraq. That was not entirely cynical. It was an intelligent use of limited assets in the context of a worldwide geopolitical struggle. The problem with a foreign policy driven foremost by never again is that it ignores limits and the availability of resources. World War II had the secondary moral effect of saving what was left of European Jewry. Its primary goal and effect was to restore the European and Asian balance of power in a manner tolerable to the United States, something that the Nazis and the Japanese fascists had overturned. Of course, the Soviet Union wrested control of Eastern Europe for nearly half a century following the war. But again, limited resources necessitated an American alliance with the mass murderer Stalin against the mass murderer Hitler. It is because of such awful choices and attendant compromises, in which morality intertwines with amorality, that humanitarians will frequently be disappointed with the foreign policy of even the most heroic administrations. World War II certainly involved many hideous compromises and even mistakes on President Franklin D. Roosevelt's part. He got into the war in Europe very late. He did not bomb the rail tracks leading to the concentration camps. He might have been more aggressive with the Soviets on the question of Eastern Europe. But as someone representing the interests of the millions of strangers who had and had not voted for him, his aim was to defeat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan in a manner that cost the fewest American soldiers' lives and utilized the least amount of national resources. Saving the remnants of European Jewry was a moral consequence of his actions, but his methods contained tactical concessions that had fundamental amoral elements. Abraham Lincoln, for his part, brought mass suffering upon Southern civilians in the last phase of the Civil War in order to decisively defeat the South. the total war waged by Generals William Tecumseh Sherman and Ulysses S. Grant was evidence of that. Simply put, there are actions of state that are the right things to do, even if they cannot be defined in terms of conventional morality. Amoral goals, properly applied, do have moral effects. Indeed, in more recent times, President Richard Nixon and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, rushed arms to Israel following a surprise attack by Arab armies in the fall of 1973. The two men essentially told the American defense establishment that supporting Israel in its hour of need was the right thing to do because it was necessary to send an unambiguous message of resolve to the Soviets and their Arab allies at a critical stage in the Cold War. Had they justified the arms transfers purely in terms of helping embattled post-Holocaust Jewry, rather than in terms of power politics as they did, it would have made for a much weaker argument in Washington, where officials rightly had American interests at heart more than Israeli ones. George McGovern was possibly a more ethical man than either Nixon or Kissinger, but had he been elected president in 1972, would he have acted so wisely and so decisively during the 1973 Middle East War? The fact is, individual perfection, as Machiavelli knew, is not necessarily synonymous with public virtue. Then there is the case of Deng Xiaoping. Deng approved the brutal suppression of students at Beijing's Tiananmen Square in 1989. For that, he is not respected among humanitarians in the West. But the consolidation of Communist Party control that followed the clampdown allowed for Deng's methodical, market-oriented reforms to continue for a generation in China. Perhaps never before in recorded economic history have so many people seen such a dramatic rise in living standards, with an attendant rise in personal, if not political, freedoms in so short a time frame. Thus, Deng might be considered both a brutal communist and the greatest man of the 20th century. The morality of his life is complex. The Bosnia and Kosovo interventions of 1995 and 1999 are frequently held out as evidence that the United States is most effective when it acts according to its humanitarian values, never mind its amoral interests. But those who make that argument neglect to mention that the two successful interventions were eased by the fact that America operated in the Balkans with the balance of power strongly in its favor. Russia in the 1990s was weak and chaotic under Boris Yeltsin's incompetent rule, and thus temporarily less able to challenge the United States in a region where, historically, the Tsars and Commissars had exerted considerable sway. However, Russia, even in the 1990s, still exerted considerable sway in the Caucasus, and thus a Western response to halt ethnic cleansing there during the same decade was not even considered. More broadly, the 1990s allowed for ground interventions in the Balkans because the international climate was relatively benign. China was only just beginning its naval expansion, endangering our Pacific allies, and September 11th still lay in the future. Truly, beyond many a moral response lies a question of power that cannot be explained wholly in terms of morality. Thus, to raise morality as a sole arbiter is ultimately not to be serious about foreign policy. R2P must play as large a role as realistically possible in the affairs of state, but it cannot ultimately dominate. Syria is the current and best example of this. U.S. power is capable of many things, yet putting a complex and war-torn Islamic society's house in order is not one of them. In this respect, our tragic experience in Iraq is indeed relevant. Quick fixes like a no-fly zone and arming the rebels may topple Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, but that might only make President Barack Obama culpable in midwifing to power a Sunni jihadist regime, even as ethnic cleansing of al-Assad's Alawites commences. At least at this late juncture, without significant numbers of Western boots on the ground for a significant period, something for which there is little public support, the likelihood of a better, more stable regime emerging in Damascus is highly questionable. Frankly, there are just no easy answers here, especially as the pro-Western regime in Jordan is threatened by continued Syrian violence. R2P applied in 2011 in Syria might actually have yielded